Hey everyone, welcome back to the Dadcore Cinema Club. It's a celebration of the cable classic, the middlebrow masterpiece, those movies that never stop reminding you of the importance of safe driving, no matter how many times you watch them. I am your host, as always, Brandon. Joining me, as always, is Charlie.
It's me, Charlie.
It's Charlie. If you listened last week, you would have heard us talk about 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, that 1954 Disney classic from Richard Fleischer.
Yeah, you got it.
I nailed it in one. If you haven't listened to it, go back, check it out. It was a really fun one to record.
Loved that one.
But what also is going to be fun to record is this week's episode, in which we're talking about not submarines this time, but vroom vroom cars. We're talking about Death Race 2000.
No submarines?
No submarines in this one.
I watched Depth Race 2000. A race to the bottom. No, yeah, we're also going from, at the time, the most expensive movie ever made to a movie that costs like $300,000.
It's basically the same, though, if you think about it.
Yeah, adjusted for inflation, who knows?
I don't really know what money was worth. You know, $5 million in 1954, I mean, there was like a crash in the 70s, right? I mean, it's probably about the same.
Yeah. It is a... Because you mentioned at the beginning of every episode, the middlebrow masterpiece. I think we're finally getting to dip into the lowbrow masterpiece this time. Getting our hands dirty a little bit.
We're griming it. We're getting in the mud. We're digging deep.
Yeah. Getting into our guy, Corman. Roger Corman.
Our good friend and yours.
Yeah, friend of the show.
Maybe the most influential filmmaker in American filmmaking history.
Yeah, I put it out there and no one offered up any other single person that convinced me that he wasn't, that he didn't have the biggest impact. So, you know, good for you, Roger. You did it.
I mean, in terms of careers this guy touched and launched in one way or another, Peter Bogdanovich, James Cameron, Francis Ford Coppola, Joe Dante, Ron Howard, Jack Nicholson, Martin Scorsese, John Sayles, Irvin Kershner,
Stallone,
Martin Cove.
You got Stallone in this one.
And David Carradine.
And David Carradine, yeah. Mary Warnov.
Yeah, just like it was the Roger Corman school of film. It was a lot of the new Hollywood guys passed through his production house at one point or another. And whether as like a camera op, James Cameron got his start as a camera op on like Battle Beyond the Stars, I think. And, or just like directing a movie. Obviously, everyone knows Martin Scorsese directed Boxcar Bertha. And while it's not a good movie, he learned a lot about working within like a tight budget and making a movie as a crowd pleaser from there. Like people went through Roger Corman and came out great directors one way or another.
Yeah. And not just like, on an artistic level, I think his main thing he was good at instilling is how to crank out something that will turn a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his whole deal. I don't think he had many delusions about going out there and making art. He was going out there and cranking out as many movies as possible and just living on the margins.
The guy was making business. And people came out of his like films learning how to stretch a budget. It was like James Cameron's lesson. I remember from like a talk he did like a decade ago. He talked about like how he learned how to stretch a special effects budget to get the most out of it. Which, if you've seen a James Cameron movie, you've seen how much further a dollar goes on his screen than in almost any other director's screen.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of Corman being a businessman, Death Race 2000, one of like the most businessy business moves that a movie could make. Like there was buzz around Rollerball, which was coming out in 1975, and there was pre-release buzz. People were murmuring about this new upcoming movie about a future sport, and it's a satire of capitalism through this and violence in media through the lens of this sport. And Corman saw all the buzz around it and went, I want that. And so he immediately fast-tracked a script, which then became Death Race 2000, which then released in 75 months before Rollerball.
Scoop like, him. Got his
yeah,
ass.
Movie is getting buzz. Corman rushes out a script. If like younger listeners aren't familiar with Corman, he's sort of like the asylum of his day.
I mean, and it fucking worked. Like it if I'm looking worked. At box office, this thing made $5 to $8 million. Made back 10 times its budget at least.
Huge hit.
Which in a little thing, him talking about it, he was saying that like all of his movies made a little bit of money, and then some of them went on to, you know, like gain cult status later on, but this one was just like an immediate success, like immediately popular, immediately well liked.
Yep. Death Race 2000 didn't need a long tail to succeed. It didn't have to like go to home video and make back money over the years. It just smashed success, just blew up all over immediately.
Yeah.
People wanted to see what he was selling. People wanted to see these cars hit some folks on the road.
Some weird, trashy stuff. Yeah, I thought it was really funny. It says on the Wikipedia page that Corman originally wanted Peter Fonda for the lead, but then he read the script and was like, no.
I think it, like, didn't Peter Fonda say it was like unfilmable or something?
Yeah, it was just too ridiculous. Did not want any part of...
He didn't want to be in the live-action Wacky Racers movie.
Yeah, his loss. He fucked up on that one, I think.
Yeah, but so instead they got David Carradine, who was like coming off of success on the TV show Kung Fu.
Yeah, he was tired of playing a Chinese guy. He was worried about being typecast as a white Chinese guy.
Yeah, he was playing Kwai Chang Kane on Kung Fu. And now he's playing Frankenstein in the movies. He wanted to go to the big screen, and so they gave I think he was most of the budget for this movie. Like, most of the budget went to, we need to get David Carradine. The rest of it went to, we need to have some explosions. And that was it.
Yeah, because we mentioned Stallone is in it too, but was not yet a big star or anyone.
Yeah, this was like Stallone's second Corman movie because he was in Capone. And I believe, isn't like his next movie after this Rocky? It's either his next movie or the movie after that. So this is like not only an early Stallone, it is literally right before he becomes one of the biggest stars in the world.
It's funny that it's after Capone because he's in this movie. It looks like just leftover wardrobe. It's like,
I mean, it probably is leftover wardrobe,
gangster clothes
from Capone. But it's interesting to see like Stallone in this movie because he's playing the bad guy, right? He is like a goofy, over the top bully, a kind of character that he would stop playing like 2 years later.
Yeah, he's like a cartoon. He's Joe Viterbo.
It's the last time he would kind of play that character, that kind of role. Like, he becomes movie star, capital M movie star, 2 years later.
He's so funny in this. So stupid.
But speaking of this, what is this? What is Death Race 2000?
Oh, yeah. Right.
Just assuming everyone knows what it is.
Is it supposed to be the year 2000? Did I ever say that?
Yeah, it's the year 2000 and...
The distant future.
The far-off future of 2000, after the world crash of 79, all of the markets crashed because of France.
Yeah, the treacherous French.
The treacherous French wrecked our economy.
Wrecked our economy.
And so 21 years later, they make Death Race. And it's just, they have four cars. It's four cars.
Yes.
They got to race from New York to L.A., and hit as many people as possible. And you get points for hitting people. That's the whole setup. It's a dystopian, of like a fascist United States.
Yeah, it's more than four cars. Because you got Frankenstein, you got Joe Machine Gun Viterbo, you got Calamity Jane Kelly, you got Matilda the Hun, Nero the Hero.
So it's five.
That's it. Yeah, there's five. One of them dies immediately, to be fair. Nero the Hero barely makes it out of the gates. But yeah, we are in this kind of quasi-fascist near future United States.
It's not clear if the president's even... They call him the president, but I'm pretty sure it's not an elected position.
Yeah, they say multiple times that like he doesn't live in the United States. Like the movie opens on a marching band playing the national anthem and people waving like swastika flags.
There's a Nazi in the, they show like one Nazi kid, one kid with a Nazi flag in the stands. And then they show like a crowd of them. And then one of the racers, because the racers all have like a gimmick and it's not clear. I think they are like pro wrestler gimmicks. I think that's just like they put it on. So there's Nazis in the stands, but I think they're just like,
they're just fans of the Nazi.
They're just fans.
Tank.
It's like if the WWE had a Nazi villain. And so they sold like swastika merchandise and you just wore it to the show and then you had to explain to people as you left, like no, it's I'm just a fan, this is merch.
So yeah, I guess the people in the stands, you know, maybe we're just big fans.
They're just big fans. It's just, yeah, I'm just like, I mean, they're Nazis too probably. I'm just saying, like, it's like a pro wrestling thing. It's like we're in the fans, like there's Nazis in the stands, but it's like they're wearing it as merch.
Yeah, and like the Nazi car people do say stuff like, oh, this will be won by members of the master race and something. But you don't, yeah, they are saying that like to the news, because so like they are racing across the country, but also you get points for killing people as you go.
Yeah, so you're, they don't get into much in this movie. So like, it's not clear if it's more important to get there faster or to get more points from hitting people.
They say at the end that there's a possibility that Frankenstein could lose even if he wins the race because he's so far behind Machine Gun Joe on killing people points.
So but it's just not clear kind of, what like winning the deduction. Race, like being first, how many points is that worth, is not like super clear.
There's also,
what's
like,
the meta? Do you want to be first or do you want to like be slow and get more kills?
Well, there's also like stages of the race, like the Tour de France, where they all like stop at like massage houses and have dinner together and shit. So that and like they never really make it seem like you get an advantage from being the first person to the end of the stage. Very unclear what the rules of the transcontinental race are.
It, or the politics of the world. Like, are the people in the stands, is it because, is this woman a Nazi character because it's just like the Iron Sheik being an Iran character? It's, oh, we're playing, it's, I'm playing a character? Or is she a representative of like a Nazi faction of the US? Like, what are the politics of this world? Not really explored, because the movie is just about genre thrills, really.
Yeah, even the like near future aspect of it, there's one, I even hesitate to call it a matte painting because it looks like a drawing from like a children's book of like the future city that they're,
it looks like a kid did it with crayons, and I don't want to, like, no disrespect to the artist who drew it, because I know you had to do it for $5, but it's interesting that we're talking about this movie right after 20,000 Leagues, where like 20,000 Leagues is full of incredible matte paintings. Just some of the most beautiful matte paintings you will see in a movie are in that movie. The movie costs $5 million. Every bit of it is on screen. It's just astounding. And like, you can tell they're paintings, but they're just beautiful. And then this movie, there's the one matte painting, and it's charming is what I'll call it.
Yeah.
But it is also like the cheapest matte painting I've ever seen.
Yeah. It's like one colored pencil drawing that they use like four times composited in.
Yeah, and it's composite again. It's this stadium, and they try to composite a city and also make the stands look bigger.
Yeah.
And it's like a future city, and there's like a rail car that goes in the background, but it's just like this bright green light that goes along a rail, and it sticks out so much.
It's so fun. Like, so much of this movie is so funny, and there's like a really high knowing like camp kitsch factor to it all. Like, there throughout the whole thing, there's this like Hunger Games news crew that's like in love with the race and in love with reporting on it. That's really funny.
I love the announcer a lot. That guy is, I don't know the actor's name. He is very good, though. I love his voice. He's just a perfect announcer voice for the whole movie.
All the names in this are great, too. The one lady announcer. Her name is Miss Pander. The director of this movie, who apparently is the one that, you know, put this comedic tone over the whole thing, pops up in the movie as like a the doctor bringing Frankenstein out at the very beginning.
Important to note, the racer's name is Frankenstein, not the doctor.
Yes.
They got it right.
The doctor the is Frankenstein's doctor.
Yes. Actually, Frankenstein's the name of the driver. A doctor is the name of his doctor. Yeah, yeah. So they introduce all the racers at the beginning. They have that chintzy background, which is like so cute. And they have these race cars. And there's five race cars. And one of them is the Nazi. The other one is Joe Machine Gun Viterbo, who's played by Sylvester Stallone. Like, might as well just be coming out of a mob movie. I haven't seen Capone, but it's probably, like you said, it's probably reusing the Capone costume. There's no way.
Yeah.
And he has like machine guns on the front. I don't think the guns work, but he says machine guns where his headlight should be. And then a giant knife
on the hood of his car. On the front.
The Nazi lady has a cannon, but it doesn't, it's just like for show. Then there's Martin Cove playing Ray, Nero the hero Lonigan, who's supposed to be, I guess, like a Roman guy.
Yeah, they're like eating grapes.
Yeah, and he's also playing it as gay.
Yeah.
For some reason. Apparently it wasn't supposed to be a gay character, and Martin Cove came into the audition just playing it super gay. And they loved it, so they told him to do it.
Yeah, you gotta make those kind of choices to get into a movie like this.
Then there was Calamity Jane, who is like a cowgirl.
Yeah, she's got like a bull car.
Yeah, she got a bull car.
It's got big horns on it.
And then finally, there is Frankenstein, played by David Carradine. He gets wheeled out by his doctor, and it's like, he just had a new arm installed. Everyone stay back. He's under slumber, and he's under this like white sheet. Mm. And they take it off, and they do first person for a while. Like, they're hiding Carradine. They don't want you to see him. But then they do, and it's just like Carradine in a gimp mask.
Yeah, with some, like, his eyes messed up underneath it, kind of, it looks like.
He's like in a full gimp suit. He's covered in black leather head to toe.
And he's the returning two-time champion, the only two-time champion ever of the transcontinental race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the implication with him is that, like, he has been blown up and mutilated and put back together. Which is why he's Frankenstein.
Yeah, they keep talking about, like, the crash of 96, the crash of 97.
Lost my leg in 99, lost my arm in 97.
And the Swiss doctors.
Yes, they keep mentioning Swiss doctors. The
Swiss doctors hooked
him up. There's a moment where he says, like, not even the Swiss doctors could put him back together.
All the king's Swiss doctors and all the king's Swiss men couldn't put Frankenstein together again. But the general population seems to fucking love this
death race.
Except for this group of factory workers that comprise the rebellion.
They keep cutting to this like factory, which just looks like it's just like the crew from Blue Collar just hanging out and going like, we hate this race.
Yeah, they're working at the rebellion factory.
They're manufacturing consent. they just got mad. I'm tired of manufacturing consent to the manufacturing consent factory.
And they're like led by this matriarch named Thomasina Payne.
And they're going to undermine their race. And there's like this, like, again, there's this like a little bit, this light political angle where Thomasina wants to play it peacefully and undermine the race by winning the hearts and minds or whatever. And like her number two is like, we're going to blow everyone up and kill them.
Yeah. And they've infiltrated Frankenstein's car. Their navigator is Thomasina's granddaughter. Every car has a driver and a navigator. That's important, I guess. It's like rally car racing. But also, apparently they're all like fucking each other. That's part of it. Very sexy movie. I don't know if it's sexy. There's a lot of people having sex in it, I guess.
Yeah, there's like boobs and butts, but in Roger Corman's own words, he made a tits and ass picture.
Yeah. He knows what the people want to see.
Yeah, it's not like a sexy movie. It's just they keep talking about sex and they keep showing people's boobs. But yeah, because like they're on the starting line and like at the beginning, Calamity Jane is hitting on the Nazi navigator.
Yeah. Well, they like at the very beginning, they're like, oh, we wish you luck with the race and with your lovers or whatever. And she's like, oh, I don't need luck in the race. And if I had any more luck with my lovers, I wouldn't even make it to the race.
Mm-hmm.
All about it, getting it.
Yeah, I think like all the people do in future America is run over pedestrians and have sex.
That's the future. That's the future liberals want.
That's the future I'm building to.
We'll get there someday.
That's what I'm investing in with my student loan forgiveness. All the money I was paying to my student loans is I'm going to put toward funding my political party that will get us to the death race future.
I mean, we're past due on it. We're 22 years past where we should be. We're well behind. Calamity Jane, also should be noted, played by Mary Warrenov, who was a frequent collaborator of the director of this movie and was like a former Warhol factory person. Pops up in a lot of like cult movies. Seems like a very cool person. She's great.
She seems awesome.
I like her a lot.
One note about the cars at the start of this, we described them a bit. They look like Hot Wheels.
Yeah, they don't look like real cars.
They don't.
Frankenstein's car is like a lizard thing. I don't really get it.
Yeah, it's like an alligator.
Okay, what's going on there?
It's like green. It's got alligator skin. There's like a spiky mohawk on it for some reason.
Yeah, all the other people have car themes that are like loosely tied to their whole deal. I mean, he's just got like a lizard car.
Yeah. They all look like you took the Honey I Shrunk the Kids, or actually Honey I Blew Up the Kids laser, and you took it to my Hot Wheels collection when I was a kid, and you blew those up and you had to drive those around. Because yeah. What they did, I guess what they did for the cars is he bought like BMWs, like used BMWs because the engine's in the back. And then he took off the body and had his prop guy build new bodies for all the cars.
That's what it looks like. It looks like a bunch of like fiberglass cars.
Yeah. And they all look like they're made of plastic, which is like, it's part of the charm of the movie. I like that they look like Hot Wheels, but it's very goofy, very silly that they look like Hot Wheels.
Like, even like the knife on the front of Stallone's car, it doesn't look like a knife that could cut you. It looks like a big prop.
Yeah, it looks like it's made of plastic. It's
but I mean, I do see it cut a bunch of people up, so
it's an effective
thing to say how dangerous it is.
Yeah, their cars are all boxy. Like they all look like, you know what they actually look like? You ever run like Cub Scouts? You do like the Pinewood Derby.
Yeah, the Pinewood
Derby.
You take
a block of wood, yep. And no matter what you do, unless you have like the most skilled dad in the fucking club, then obviously you could have a beautiful car. Most people's cars look like blocks of wood. Like even when you've cut it up to make it aerodynamic and you've done a bunch to it, it still is going to end up looking like you carved a block of wood. It's going to be inherently blocky unless you're like a fucking, you know, jigsaw genius.
Yeah,
that's what these cars look like. They look like he started with a block and had to carve it out. They all look like they're all boxy as hell.
They're all very low polygon count.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are PlayStation 1 cars. Not even. These are like SNES cars.
Yeah, they're cruising world. But then once the race starts, it's like the movie's just going. They immediately come up on some construction workers who are apparently like the only people on Earth that don't like aren't aware that they shouldn't be out in the middle of the road during this death race.
I'm not clear. It doesn't matter because it's just a silly, goofy movie. But like, I would not be on the road.
Yeah, I would be.
I would be home.
I'd be like, watching.
They
the
announced
big game.
It's not a surprise that there's death race today, right?
No, they love this. There's a
why are you jackhammering?
Yeah,
middle of the road.
I don't know. There's a part.
Oh, you know what? I solved it. I think they probably just get like they get hazard pay, probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're making bank for right. being out.
I mean,
there
this
on
is a dystopia.
Road.
It seems like there's nothing going on except bread and circuses. So, like, you know, your boss says, "Look, dude, hazard pay. Maybe it's the only way you can put food on your family. You gotta get out in the middle of that road and jackhammer a bunch in the middle of the race."
I mean, there also is another guy that's just out there fishing.
That guy's cool, though.
He is.
He was off. He wasn't even in the way of the race, though.
No, yeah, he was off doing his own thing.
Hanging out.
Wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, there's like three construction workers in the middle of the road. Two of them run away. They don't even tell their buddy. Like, when the dude's just jackhammering, and his buddy is just like, they run away, but they don't bother to, like, tap him on the shoulder. Like, hey, dude, like, run, maybe.
And the best part of this is the guy gets, like, like cut through the crotch. He's like screaming. It immediately cuts away, and the announcer is like, "On the first kill of the race, and it's a clean kill. The person experienced no pain."
I love that line too. Yeah, it's very funny, but it also like implies this level of the announcers being like in on the proliferation of the race as like distraction for society.
Oh yeah, they're like fully complicit in this. Like
he is telling the audience like, don't worry about it. Okay, if the car hits you, it's not a big deal.
Like that's the most like, I think, cogent, like well thought through actual like satirical bit of this movie is the news people and their role in all of this.
That news announcer reminds me a lot of, and actually the whole movie reminds me of this movie, but that news announcer specifically in that angle of the media and its complicitness in violence, like that idea of the commodification of violence and violence in mass media and the way that news media sells violence. Even just through their news coverage, reminds me a lot of Natural Born Killers, which I feel like is a direct, that movie feels like a direct descendant of this movie.
Yeah, I can definitely see. I wasn't thinking about that when I watched it, but I can understand where that's coming from for sure.
Yeah, that race announcer is like, I feel like the Robert Downey Jr. character, Natural Born Killers, direct descendant of that.
Yeah.
Character type.
What I was getting the whole time was just the Stanley Tucci guy in The Hunger Games. It's just like incredibly happy to be like interviewing these people that are trying to kill each other. And like the game showness of it all. Like the first person that dies, the Miss Pander goes to like interview his widow. They like give her a prize. That's such a
funny scene.
What? They give her something.
Yeah, she's like on a daytime talk show. She brings her out like on the couch. She's like, "We have a wonderful guest. Come on out, honey." And it's this crying widow. Bawling her eyes out. They're like, "Don't worry. Like, we got you. Aren't you happy? We got you something." It was they got her like an apartment in New York or something.
Yeah. She got, yeah. She gets,
it was Acapulco.
Vacation.
It was, yeah, it was an apartment in Acapulco. It's like, "Yay, we got you a home. We got you housing." But yeah, you only get that because she was the first one to die.
They take care of her.
I don't think the other victims get anything. Just the first one.
Well, I think the very next one is Frankenstein knows that it's euthanasia day at the geriatric home. And there's people just like orderlies wheeling old people out into the middle of the street to run them over.
Yeah, that's that is like an example of the kind of black humor that the director was putting into this. Of the euthanasia day, but Frankenstein veers off the course, does not hit any of the euthanasia patients who I would assume if it's euthanasia day were opting in to go.
Oh no.
He instead kills all the nurses.
I think they were just getting wheeled out there so they didn't have to deal with these old people anymore.
Well, he killed the nurses instead. Turn the tide.
They mentioned earlier that the rules have changed this year, that you get more points for killing old people and young children.
It's 100 points for an old person. It's the most points.
Because that's how Nero, he's the first one to get got because the rebels put a fake baby, which he's very
he gets
keen
Looney
to go
Tunes.
Run over this little baby.
He's the first person in the movie to get Looney Tunes. And there was way more Looney Tunes in this movie than I expected.
They do the tunnel gag to somebody.
Yeah. But first they do to Martin Cove. They have a family doing a picnic. And he's like, he gets real horny for the kill and he runs at him. Then it turns out the lady was actually a rebel guy in drag. And the baby is not a baby. It's a baby doll with dynamite and a speaker to make it sound like it's crying. Fantastic. He hits the dynamite and dies.
Oldest trick in the book. The old dynamite baby.
Before we get too far past it, there's something like an actual element of the visuals of this movie that I really like that happened early on. It's when they filmed the president.
Yeah.
And the president is in this like palace. I can't remember where it was. It's not in the U.S. He's abroad in his palace in some other country hanging out. And it's this like they're very clearly trying to hide their set. So it's like they just fill the set with smoke. It's all smoke. And the camera's like kind of a little blurry. And he's like coming through as a silhouette, backlit on this bright, blown out orange light, and fog machines filling him. There's like vaguely like a staircase and a building in the background, but you can't really make it out through the fog. And it gives him this like ominous aura as he talks to the crowd. And what he says is like he describes the future they're in, the dystopia, the fact that like the economy crashed in 79, but I give you what you want. He gives him the death race. And I know that line was from this movie. Once again, I give you what you want.
There's a few like really cool looking parts of this movie, like aside from just kind of being like fun to look at because they're so tacky. Because like sometimes the president too is speaking kind of like Patton style in front of a huge flag of their new flag that just has like a big fist on it.
Isn't it like a fist and a lightning bolt?
Yeah, with like the, it still has the stripes of the American flag, but that's where the stars are, is a big lightning fist.
It should have the fucking the bicep from Always Sunny. It's my new version of this movie.
The also like around this time of the beginning of the movie, there's like a matador guy that's like messing with the Calamity Jane car.
Good thing he found the one bull car.
Yeah, he was waiting out there to get run over, I guess. Like, I don't
imagine
understand.
Imagine if Stallone found him first. Like, he would been a mismatch. He'd there.
Been machine gunned.
Yeah.
But I don't really understand what his like end game was for that.
I don't know what that guy was going for as a character, as like a character motivation, but he was looked like he was having fun.
He did.
Because like, he was toroing the hell out of that car.
With real bullfighting, you know, you stab the bull as it goes by and it gets tired from you like torturing it or whatever. But I mean, this guy was dealing with a car, a person in a car.
He wasn't really fighting the car. He was just kind of like doing it. And man, she was fucking up her driving. I mean,
she was gonna piss at that guy.
But I guess maybe she was seeing red.
He's good.
He's the world's best bullfighter.
You gotta hand it to him. He's been doing that at every death race. She's the first one to get him.
That's why maybe they give the cars to like the next year's drivers, and he is like, he's defeated every year's previous bull driver. She's the first one to get him.
That's why she's not the best. Frankenstein's the best.
Mm-hmm.
Which like that's his whole thing, is that he's the best. And Joe Viterbo's whole thing is that he's extremely jealous of Frankenstein.
He's extremely jealous of like his fandom. Because like Joe Viterbo's the only other guy who's won. Or and is still alive, I guess, is actually.
Yeah.
He's a one-time winner. Frankenstein's a two-time winner. I guess everyone else who's won is dead.
And man, people really do love Frankenstein. They after the first like leg of the race, they get to their first pit stop. And there's like this cult of Frankenstein girls that are like in love with him.
Yeah, this girl walks up to him and offers. She doesn't like the implications there. She doesn't say it, but she's like, I wanted to meet you so it would be meaningful. Like, she wants to meet him so that she could lay out in the road and die.
Yeah, he says like,
to give him points.
He asks if she's like trying to have sex with him. And she's like, oh, no, that's for your navigator to do. I wouldn't want to step on any toes. And then he's like, okay, well, if you're not trying to sleep with me, get the hell out of here.
That's the because that's the massage scene, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of asses.
Yeah, that is. So everyone's like nude and getting massage except Frankenstein, because he doesn't get naked, he doesn't take off the mask. And like that scene is interesting, like knowing, because I watched a behind the scenes video with Roger Corman and some other people talking about it. And what Roger Corman had to say about that scene was Stallone didn't want to do it because he didn't want to get naked on screen. And Corman told him, you know, I'm making a tits and ass movie. You need to. So the compromise was that Stallone wears a towel the whole scene.
He's got the world's tiniest towel on his butt. It like doesn't even cover his whole butt. What a coward.
Mm-hmm. But right around this time, too, the navigator asks Frankenstein why he wants to win and why he kills people. And he's just like, it's the only measure of success we have left.
Yeah, I have that written down too. The only measure of success we have left in this world.
Man. Not even video games anymore? Not even posting?
It's real now.
I think these days that's what posting is, the only measure of success we have left.
Well, they just made the fun way to play Grand Theft Auto into real life.
Yeah, this movie was inspired by Grand Theft Auto.
This part, too, has a really cool looking just like part of the movie where like Carradine is like stripped down to his underwear, but he's still wearing the gloves and the mask, and they like dance together, and they're in this all red room.
I think the look of that set, there's two different like hotel room sets that are very clearly they dressed up like a rec center court or something. But it creates this like otherworldly and really striking visual because it is like just this wide open room. It's just like a stage. And then the bed is floating in the middle and not floating above the ground. I just mean like it's not up against a wall. It's not in line with any other furniture. There isn't like it doesn't look like a room that you know of.
Yeah.
It's just here's a bed in the middle of the room. It's not even head on. It's like at an angle. There's like a nightstand next to it and like a chair over here. But all the stuff's like floating in the middle of like a warehouse, basically.
Yeah,
and it gives it this like really striking visual between this plain floor, plain walls, and then the furniture in these scenes is usually like very bright.
Yeah, there's no like overhead light. There's just like a row of lamps. Mm-hmm. It's like this big block of like primary color that they're standing in.
And it's clearly like a remnant of it's coming out of the budget.
Yeah.
Constraints is that they had to make a hotel room as cheaply as possible. So they just put a bunch of items in the middle of a stage, but it creates a striking image. They are able to pull out of this budgetary constraint, like an interesting visual.
Yeah. It looks really cool. They found something. I have written down here that around this time in the movie, I was watching it on Tubi and that scene got interjected with a ad for boneless wings at Applebee's. With Any Way You Want It playing.
Okay.
So now that's part of the movie for me.
Do we get money for that ad?
Yeah, that was a covert backdoor ad read I just did for Applebee's Boneless Applebee's. Wings.
If you want to send a check, I am copacetic to this idea.
If you want to mail us some boneless wings.
Do that too.
Yeah, then the next stage has some funny stuff too. Like the... One of the cars does like a back tire burnout on a guy's body that just like sprays blood everywhere.
Yeah, that's is that the fisherman?
It might be the fisherman. Or, I don't think it is. I think Calamity Jane's the one that does it to whoever. The fisherman guy is really funny because he's fishing and Joe Paterno comes up to him and he's like, "Oh yeah, I know who you are. I love you. I've got posters of you in my room. You're Frankenstein." And he's Stallone says like 2 seconds and you're dead. Runs back to his car.
Yeah, the guy has to run away. He like hides against like the bank of the river for a bit, like Frodo hiding underneath the tree stump from the fucking ring race.
Stallone peering over, all the bugs crawling away.
Stallone just drives his car off the cliff and just chases this guy down, burns out over his head. This is around this time the fucking Looney Tunes tunnel. So this is how the Nazi goes out. She's like chasing Calamity Jane, trying to run her off the road. No, Calamity Jane's chasing her, trying to run her off the road. And the Nazi like sees a there's like they cut to the resistance setting up a detour sign and then like slowly erecting this like very clearly cardboard tunnel.
It's very got like a painted black curtain in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's like, and it's not like. In Looney Tunes, they would paint the tunnel on the side of a cliff. They just put a like cardboard facade of a tunnel up in the middle of a dirt path where there's nothing around it on either side and then put a detour sign. And the Nazi's like, a detour? Ugh. And then just goes right through the tunnel and off a cliff.
There's a...
It's incredible.
It happens earlier than where we're at now, but there's another like visual gag where some... rebel guys have like built a little wall that they're like sitting behind and then one of the cars just drives up from behind them and crushes both of them. And the rebels try to like trap Frankenstein at one point before that and like replace him with their own driver. It just doesn't work at all.
No, his navigator directs him down a different path. He just doesn't stop driving and runs over the guy who is supposed to replace him. Like, their plan seemed to be predicated on the idea that his car would stop and they could get him out of the car, but he didn't stop. He just kept driving because
that's what he does.
The rebels don't seem to have a good plan.
Yeah, they don't really understand the rules.
I think they're really good at, like, Looney Tunes gags. They're really good at, like, being little rascals, little scamps. They don't seem very good at higher thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how much better the world is going to be if the rebel coup ever actually happens.
Yeah. They don't seem very capable. But after the Nazi dies, they go get dinner in Albuquerque. They're on, like, the other side of the country now. And Stallone is eating cream with his hand.
Yeah, so funny. It's all over his face.
Yeah, the scene starts and there's just, like, cream on it. He's like, what is going on? Like, how did he get a messy face? And then he just dips his fucking fingers into this pool of cream and just starts, like, putting it in his mouth.
The brutest way. They're meeting with some, like, PR guy, too, because the president and the PR team are trying to keep under wraps that the rebels even exist. They're, like, blaming mm-hmm. all of these attacks on the French, the treacherous French.
Yeah, it's Calamity Jane and Machine Gun Viterbo. And they're like, you got to keep us safe. We're race car drivers, not, you know, guys who are supposed to be in danger. And the dude's just like, that's not a big deal. We captured... He was like, it was a crazy lady. Because the old lady, the leader of the resistance, hacked the cameras. She max headroomed them.
Yeah, she does pull a max headroom incident on them.
Yeah, she hacks into the cameras and announces her intent to stop the race forever in the middle of the broadcast. And so they're scared. They're spooked. And they're just like, she was a crazy lady and we arrested her. She was one of the French. Apparently all the jokes about the French were the idea of the director. So he wanted the movie, Paul Bartel, he wanted the movie to be a comedy. He saw it as, like, a jokey picture. And so he put in all the, like, I think the Looney Tunes style gags were his idea, like the tunnel and the old people, like the and all the jokes about the French were, like, his idea. And Corman saw this as, like, a serious and violent sci-fi movie. And so, like, that was, like, their clash between Corman wanting this to be this, like, grindhouse picture and Bartel wanting it to be, like, a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, the French jokes he said were, like, one of the jokes that he got through, because I think Corman cut out a lot of the humor in the editing.
Yeah, I know he went back with, like, a second unit and shot a bunch mm-hmm. of the stunt stuff kind of behind the director's back to put into the movie.
Yeah, the shot where a guy, you said the car burns out on the guy's head and just, like, a pool of blood shoots out. That was a reshoot later because Corman wanted to put violence back in the movie because they thought that Bartel was pulling back on the violence, making too goofy of a movie.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm only familiar with Bartel really outside of this for his movie Eating Raoul. It's just interesting that, like, he didn't see this as a violent thing because that is a very violent movie. It's about, like, him and Mary Warrenoff, like, kill and rob a bunch of like swingers.
Ooh,
funny movie. Also, like, a black comedy.
They're
very tonally similar, Death Race and Eating Raoul.
Well, I think the difference between him and Corman in this picture was he wanted the comedy to be, like, to underline everything in it, whereas Corman didn't want, like, any of the comedy in it.
Yeah, I think it's a good push-pull, though. I think they find a good space.
Yeah, because the violence they do put in ends up coming off comedic because of the context it's put in.
Yeah, and it's so low budget and just goofy looking. It's not like you're ever going to take it seriously, the violence that's happening in this.
Mm-hmm.
The Albuquerque meeting when, like, Frankenstein gets there. One thing that I thought was really funny is, like, when him and his navigator are driving and she's like, aren't you worried about, like, the rebels or whatever? And he's like, the only thing I'm worried about is Joe Viterbo. And I was just like, what? This guy's, like, an idiot. Why would you be worried about him? And then, like, when they're in Albuquerque, he just, like, easily beats the shit out of Stallone. Like, no problem. I don't understand why he would be worried about Joe Viterbo.
Joe Viterbo does get more kills than he does.
He's good. I'm not saying he's not good, but he also just
is an idiot who can't fight.
The second pit stop, she's like, oh yeah, Joe Viterbo came into the room earlier. I told him to go the wrong way. It's a dead end. And then he just does that. He just listens to the other team where to go.
The scene where he goes the wrong way is, I think, the funniest scene in the movie, because he's in the car and he's driving and he goes, she told me to go that way. It's probably a trap. I'm not that stupid. I'm not going to do it. Okay, I think I'm going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I think I'm going to do it. I'm not going to. Oh, I'm not dumb enough not to do it. I'm going to do it. He like tricks himself into the idea that it's the smart thing to follow her plan, even though he started the argument with himself knowing it's a trap.
And like the whole time he's arguing with himself, his little navigator is like, it's definitely a trap. Like, why would you do this?
Yeah, in part, he's doing it despite her, too. He's just like, fuck you. yeah, because that's a scene also where he tells her, a lot of people like you, but I think you're a... Oh, man, what is it? I think you're a large baked potato.
Oh, yeah.
And like that line, apparently, in the script was supposed to be the B word. He was supposed to say, some people might... think you're cute, but I think you're a bitch. But Stallone ad-libbed baked potato.
Which is
awesome. So much better.
That's so funny.
It's so much better.
What a pro. What a gentleman.
Yeah, I think I pulled that from a interview with John Landis.
Friend of the show.
He's in the movie.
Landis is in the movie?
He's Joe Viterbo's pit crew at the second stop. So when they leave and his pit crew's talking shit, Landis is one of those guys.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
And then Viterbo pulls the pro move of just backing up over his whole pit crew and getting some easy points.
Goofy thing about their death is it's the one, and it's a lot of the deaths in the movie like this. People in this movie just like fall over and die immediately when they're tapped by a car.
Yeah.
Part of that poisoned. Is obviously stunt budget.
The cars
are
poisoned.
Yeah, the cars have poison on them. Just like fall over.
They like those.
They put fentanyl on the cars.
Yeah,
you get a contact OD if you just touch his car.
It's an epidemic of people driving these fentanyl cars around and bumping into you. It's real.
NYPD, you know, the fucking what do they call them? The people who give you tickets. The
police.
The meter, yeah, please. The meter maids. No, meter maids reporting an epidemic of falling over, and they're trying to give tickets to cars.
Fentanyl laced cars.
But you know, it just there's a lot of people in this movie who just get barely tapped by a car and just like fall over with no blood. Like there's a couple of the kills that have like massive pools of blood, but you can tell that they used all of their squib budget on like two kills, and the rest of them are people just like falling over.
They probably. I wonder how much of the budget was the rebel plane bombing scene.
Mm-hmm. That's probably most of it.
Chasing a car with a plane, all that shit looks cool.
It was fucking good. Yeah, that's watching that scene was where I was like, fucking hell, like Roger Corman knows where to put the budget in his movie, where he, when he has $500,000, he knows you need like one big scene that puts all of your money on screen.
He definitely seems like somebody that does know what the people want to see, and like that's what this movie is about. Like,
this movie is, it's interesting because it wants to be a criticism of media that's engineered to give the people what they want. Bread and circuses, media, violence as this commodity that's being sold back to you as a distraction from the dystopian society you live in. But it doesn't have much to say about that beyond just that surface level observation. And what it really is just that.
Yeah.
What it really is just itself. A bread and circuses, watch these people die, look at this spectacle, isn't it cool, haven't I distracted you for 87 minutes?
Yeah, it can't really effectively, you know, critique people enjoying watching violence when it's just giving it to you so like uncritically and so funny, like silly.
Yeah, it's like, it's funny and not in a way that is criticizing the thing that it's joking about. It's like, isn't it funny that this lady dies because she goes through a Looney Tunes tunnel? It's like, hell yes, it is. This is really entertaining.
Yeah.
But it's like, isn't it funny that he ran over those nurses instead of the old people? We subverted your expectations. It's like, yes, that's very funny. And it's not funny in a way where I'm like, oh, it makes me think. It's just like, no, it's a spectacle movie.
Like a sight gag.
It's just goofy. This is a cartoon.
Yeah.
So like the commentary kind of just like doesn't end up working. It doesn't need to, but it's just, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I don't, it's not like it, the movie is just so goofy that like it doesn't matter that it's not saying anything. Like that's part of what makes it so fun is that it is like kind of halfway like pointing at these things.
It's having its cake and eating it too is really what it's doing. Is it's just like, isn't this stuff bad? But also, isn't this stuff good?
Yeah. Yeah. It the end of the movie too, a bunch of funny like twists start happening where you find out that Frankenstein is actually like a Dread Pirate Roberts type deal.
Yes. Oh my god. They're in the car because he found out that his navigator is a spy. And he figures it out like halfway through the movie, he doesn't give a shit. And at one point she's like, why don't you give a shit? And he's like, take off my glove. And she takes off his glove and there's a grenade. He has a metal hand and there's a grenade in it. And she's like, a grenade? And he fucking says,
a hand grenade.
A hand grenade. Yep. Fucking hell, man.
Got it.
Got him. Fucking perfect. That was the line the whole script was building to. Turns out he's a suicide bomber rebel himself.
Yeah.
I guess.
He wasn't actually put back together by Swiss doctors. He's just a different guy.
It's confusing on that point and inconsistent because he says in that scene, that they make a different Frankenstein every year. He was made this year. He says this year he was made to win to be the best race and he'll be the last Frankenstein is what he says because he's for some reason he's the Frankenstein that's going to end everything. I don't know where the other one's trying to because someone else won. He could have met the president.
Yeah. Because he's like the winner gets to shake the president's hand and he's like got the hand grenade. But I was like, yeah, he must just be a rogue Frankenstein because
like, didn't you win last time? Like, couldn't the last Frankenstein that won shake his hand?
And also like the last Frankenstein that won presumably didn't die. Why isn't he just back?
Well, I would assume that he died in the 99 crash. Maybe he won in 98, died in 99 crash or something like that.
Okay.
But
and then he was.
Yeah. Because if Machine Gun won 99. But what's unclear is because he says like there's a moment after that scene where that scene implies this Frankenstein that we're watching was born this year in a lab. And then like a couple scenes later, he says he lost his taste buds in the crash of 97, which goes back to implying that he's like the old Frankenstein.
I thought he was just saying that, though, to trick her into drinking.
He was lying, but also
potion.
She buys the lie after he told her, I was born this year. I'm 1 year old.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's on her.
Yeah. I just think the movie kind of forget. I think the movie introduces that twist and then immediately kind of forgets about it a little bit because it doesn't matter. And it went through so many rewrites that was probably like elements of this are probably remnants of like three other versions.
But then he doesn't end up getting to, you know, hand grenade kamikaze himself. His arm gets all fucked up.
Well, his arm gets all taken off.
The bombing.
Yeah, they're trying to get to the end. They're almost to LA. And suddenly the rebels appear with an aeroplane and start dropping bombs on him.
Yeah, they should have done that to begin with, I think.
Yeah, like,
should have been planned.
They have the capability to do a bombing run. They could have taken every one of these drivers out at the starting line. That's what I would have done.
No, they had to wait for them to get to New LA.
Yeah, they only had one plane, and it's in New LA.
You couldn't New LA. It. Couldn't be any worse than the old LA.
I miss the old LA.
I miss the old LA.
But yeah, that bombing run is... It looks real good. It feels like it's Roger Corman trying to do like a North by Northwest.
I mean, there's definitely a real little plane flying very close to a real car. Yeah.
I was really impressed with that sequence because the choreography that would need because you can't green screen that. Like that's real. They definitely flew a real plane by a real car. Like that would take a lot of practice. I'm sure knowing the budgets of this movie, they probably only had one shot at it.
Yeah. And
timing with explosions too.
Extremely unsafe.
Yeah. Driving next to all these explosions. Also, they only built one of each car apparently because they didn't have money to build extras. So like if anything goes wrong at any point in making this movie, they don't have a movie.
Yeah. Luckily, Corman probably had like 10 other things going. Like that was his whole model too, is that one stinker wasn't going to sink his whole operation.
Oh yeah, he was sometimes making, you know, a dozen movies at once. Basically, it feels like
king,
fucking the best. One of the people I respect the most in the film industry, basically.
Just getting it done.
But he survives the bombing run, and he has to face off with, like, Joe Viterbo. And he just, like, his navigator just rips off his hand, activates the grenade, and throws it in Joe's car.
Yep. They don't know what it is.
Like a hand, yeah, in their, yes, car. It lands, like, on the navigator, and she's like, there's a hand here. Pull the car over. There's a hand in our car. That's the trick. I thought, you know, the hand grenade was a little too simple. There's just a grenade in a hand, but I forgot that the part where it's a hand is a clever disguise.
Yeah, it tricks them. And then the navigator puts on the Frankenstein gimp suit real quick, I guess, to try and kill the president.
Switcheroo costume change.
She gets sniped by her own people. A lot of crossing and double crossing and mistaken identities going on.
Yeah, so they go to accept the president's handshake. Frankenstein goes up and shakes his hand. He gets shot, and it turns out it's the navigator. And what this is missing is when they go over, they show Frankenstein. He should have been in the navigator's lady outfit.
Yeah. Missed opportunity.
Missed opportunity to have cross-dressing David Carradine in your movie. Could have gone full Looney Tunes, get your Bugs Bunny, get a hot Carradine.
Yeah, you already had the one rebel guy in the big sun hat and the dress.
Mm-hmm.
So you already know the movie's got that in its locker. You might as well bust it back out in the end. Yeah.
What if he ended the movie looking like that? That'd be kind of funny.
He's the president. He's just still wearing her outfit. He just likes it.
Yeah.
Because it does, like, after the big blowout ending, it just kind of cuts to he's the president now.
Yeah, he drives his car into the president and kills him with his car. And then they go, welcome, President Frankenstein, and Mr. and Mrs. President Frankenstein.
You win.
Because he got married and became president. Which I didn't realize that was part of assassinating a president. I didn't realize that you became the president afterward.
Yeah, it's like the Santa Claus.
Yeah, I didn't realize that, like, so, like, actually Harvey Oswald was kind of like the 34th president or whatever.
Yeah, for a little bit.
Yeah, for like a short moment of time.
Yeah, kind of crazy. You get all their you consume their powers.
God, so our president counts way off. Well, only off by two, I guess.
Yeah, there's an alternate succession line of just some random descendants of assassins.
So the guys who assassinated the assassins, did they then become president? Man, we fucked up the president stuff, I guess.
We got to go back and untangle.
Like, the guy who killed John Wilkes Booth should be president. I mean, back then, not today.
Yeah, we should dig him up. Make him the president. He's like immediately the president. He looks great. They're married. And he's like, no more death racing. And everyone's like, yay. Except for the reporter that's like, wait, no, I love the death racing.
This is my whole job. You don't understand.
Please don't. He's like, he says something about it being violent. And the guy is like, yeah, it is violent. That's why we like it. And then he's got a sick Grease ending, only instead of flying off into the sky, they run over a guy.
Yeah, he says no more death racing because violence is bad, and then but he gets one more kill in.
One last one.
I guess if you haven't signed the law yet.
He's the president.
Yeah, he decides, so his declarations are no more death racing, also free and fair elections. And the president will live in the U.S. now.
Sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. He didn't say he was ending the war on France, though.
Well, no, they got to go down.
We still got to take out France.
They're still bad.
Do you think
that's not propaganda? The French are actually bad.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's a funny part of this movie. It's just like America's vendetta against France. Just like, it's a real life thing, but the way it manifests in this movie is very funny.
They're the enemy. They're that most hated nation.
Yeah, this movie's not afraid to say it.
Yeah, I like to think that he toned down the death racing so he could ramp up the war effort on France.
He's going to start recruiting death racers for the war effort. They're going to drive tanks.
Total war against France.
All the death racers aren't going to know how to use a tank properly. They're just going to start ramming people.
Put a big knife on the end of it. Yeah, death race. A really funny way to end it.
To just make him...
Well, it like really embodies that whole, like you said earlier, the like having your cake and eating it too. Because like the movie gets to wrap up with him saying like, oh yeah, this needless violence is bad. The reporter guy saying like, oh, we actually like the violence, and him like running him over with his car to end the movie. So like it gets to say like, it like gets to act like it's making that commentary about people enjoying watching violence and then just also indulging in it immediately.
It ends up saying nothing in the end, like, because it is, like you said, they say violence is bad, and then immediately they end on a comedy beat of violence against like an innocent guy. I mean, like, he might be, he's a, you know, commentator, but if you make the races illegal and he can no longer make money off the races, like, he's basically harmless.
I could fix him.
But no, he's murdered instead. And yeah, it's just the and apparently, according to Corman, the ending was not in the original script. They like, it was like a last minute addition. Someone suggested, wouldn't it make sense if he became president? And they went, I guess.
Not really, but let's do it anyway.
And it's like, well, we didn't plan that from the beginning and how we were writing the story, but why not? It's just, yeah, the movie's priority is what would be titillating, what would be funny, what would be exciting in the moment, and not like what fits our thematic goals.
It's like a 12-year-old's idea of wrapping up the story, like,
which, well, is why so many 12-year-olds saw it in the theater.
He won, so he's the president now. There's like a funny, when he's like being interviewed, it's like right after their wedding, and they're like, aren't you worried about having a rebel in the White House or whatever? And he's like, well, she's my wife.
I think it's, yeah, the, okay. Then the grandma pops up and she's like, hey, we'll accept any rebels in as long as they're not enemies of hate or something, like enemies of love or something like that.
As long as they'll wage war against the French.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll accept all anti-French, anti-French into our society.
There's room.
But yeah, it is like a cartoon. It's a child's idea of a movie. And something I noticed while watching it is I actually don't think it's that violent. And I have the, you know, the perspective of coming at it in 2022. And like, not like there are much more graphic movies that have released since then. Like the concept is very gratuitous, but in terms of the execution of the violence, it's so cartoony that it doesn't strike me as like a particularly exploitative movie.
Yeah, I mean, the blood doesn't look like blood. It's not, it's like,
no, it looks like paint.
If you're watching like Tom and Jerry and he hits him in the head with a frying pan and all of his teeth fall out, you're not like, ooh, it's so horrific. Like, that's what this is. It's like comparing this to a movie we talked about a couple weeks ago in like Fury, where like that's like extremely brutal.
Yeah.
Very violent. Yeah. Like, it's not the same thing, like what this movie is doing.
Like, the Equalizer's, I think, more violent than this movie.
Yeah.
But like, in just like the blood in this looks like paint. And I know like red paint squibs were really, that was the technology in the 70s. A lot of 70s movies look like that. But this is the most like can like of paint I've orange. Ever seen squibs look.
Yeah. It's not like even trying to imitate blood.
Yeah. And it's the fact that it's only used twice. I think it's only maybe three times. Most of the deaths in this movie are kind of bloodless.
Yeah.
Like, one of the ones we skipped over, there's like three dudes playing chicken in the road. Over, like, they come out of a manhole and they stand in the road, and just the three of them just stand there, and two of them get scared and jump in, and the third guy gets hit by the car because they're playing chicken, I guess. You know, last person to try to jump down the manhole gets left out because they closed it behind them. He gets hit by the car, but he gets like hit like full speed, and then he just kind of like crumples over into the fetal position with no blood. Like, that's most of the deaths. And so like, it doesn't strike me as like, oh my God, this is like a horrific movie. Save the children. It's just like it's like a cartoon.
Yeah. I mean, it's something where just like conceptually, it's something that like an edgy tween would come up with that like, oh yeah, it's like a race, and if you kill people, you get points. And if you kill a baby, you get more points. But like, as to what it's actually showing, it's like, it's just as silly as a 12-year-old talking about these things.
It's Wacky Racers, which is why it's so funny to read Roger Ebert's review of this movie.
Did he hate it? Enemy of the podcast, Roger Ebert?
The return. We haven't had an enemy of the podcast, Roger Ebert section in a while because he likes too many of the movies we've been talking about lately. He hated this movie. Oh my God. His review, most of it is about how there were too many kids in his audience. And it disgusted him deeply in a moral sense that these kids were cheering on this violence and how it represents the moral rot of society.
What a dork. I thought he liked this kind of like B-movie drive-in type deal.
I think he did, but like his audience was mostly kids. And he says the kids in his viewing in his theater were mostly unsupervised, and that like disgusted him. Here's a quote for it's like, well, folks, the theater was up for grabs. The audience was at least half small children and they loved it. They'd never seen anything so funny, I guess. And I was torn between walking out immediately and staying to witness a spectacle more dismaying than anything on the screen. The way small children were digging gratuitous bloodshed.
Gratuitous
he hated the movie because too many kids loved it. And he was right. I think this movie, I think society, you know, got so much worse after this.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, I think we can directly blame this movie for how things are today.
But no, he turned around on this movie.
I was about to ask if he ever came back to it.
He refused to re-review it, but I think it was when he was talking about the remake.
He was like, oh yeah, maybe the original wasn't so bad.
Yeah, he came around and like, oh, the original had campy fun and went on. He's like, it's a cult classic. It has a lot to add. Like he ends up admitting that he liked it like years later, but he also specifically said he would never re-review it.
He had to see what a bad Death Race movie was actually like before he could contextualize the original.
The other part of his review is talking about how if he was a kid, he would have been super scared of this movie. And so it concerns him that kids these days in 1975 were enjoying it instead. Just being a prude. I love Ebert.
Only gonna get worse.
I love these moments in like Ebert's career as a reviewer where he'll like suddenly just be like, I hate this movie for moral reasons and nothing else. Like, I'm not going to talk about the movie. I'm turned off by this.
It is really funny. Like, the movies that he randomly gets like a bee in his bonnet about gets real catty about,
especially when you consider the movies that he's written.
He was like, man, if only the blood in this movie was just replaced with more boobies, then it would be wholesome family fun.
Yeah, he was hoping it was Breast Race 2000.
now there's a movie.
He's like, I liked Stallone's earlier movies. Like the Italian Stallion.
Yeah. The reason he didn't want to get naked in this one, probably.
Oh, I guarantee you that. His reason he didn't want to get nude is probably because he was distancing himself from that at the time. I mean, like, this was probably around the time where he was at least thinking about Rocky.
Yeah.
It is insane. I mean, we'll probably cover Rocky someday, so I don't want to get too much into it. But it is insane to think that, like, this is, like, the start of Stallone's career. This is, like, his... It's like a second or third speaking role in a movie, like credited named character speaking role. And just a few years later, he'd be writer star of Rocky. And the way that he turned his career around from like, and not that this is not, he's really good in this movie, but it is not a high profile thing. And like he immediately rocketed his career after this.
Yeah, I do like him in this. He's really funny.
So good.
And he's not like really hamming it. He's like, except for like the food all over his face scene, he's like playing it fairly straight, which makes it a lot funnier. Like it really feels like he does have this deep seated like jealousy and resentment for this other guy.
He's playing such a good dumb bruiser. I think Corman said in this behind the scenes video I was watching that he was the greatest heavy he'd ever seen as soon as like he auditioned for the role, which yeah, he's fucking great.
Yeah, I really like that little bit because he says that he seemed like a great heavy, and he said his wife like pegged Stallone as a star, as a leading man immediately, and he was like, I don't think so. I don't see it.
That's a funny thing to admit. She's like, I could have had him. I could have gave him a leading role. I could have been the guy that made Stallone.
Yeah, it positions him well as a wife guy, though.
Mm-hmm. His wife, though.
Giving the props to my wife. 80 minutes. Not even. for Death Race.
Yeah, isn't it more like 79, probably?
Yeah.
Without credits. Ugh. Tight.
Yep. Gets in, gets out.
Yeah, shot by Tak Fujimoto. Speaking of like guys that got their start in Corman, he would go on to shoot Gladiator, Silence of the Lambs, Sixth Sense. Just like he was Shyamalan's go-to guy for a while there. Just like an incredible cinematographer who like gets his start on this movie, making a movie that costs $500,000.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a huge value in what the like sandbox that Corman provided for like so many people, that like he found a way to make money while also just having like pretty much anyone that wanted to and was serious about making movies do it with like little to no experience. Like from hearing people talk about what it was like, it really seems like you could just like show up in Roger Corman's office and he would just take some script out of a pile and give it to you and be like, here's $20,000, do whatever.
Yeah, and the only rule is come in under budget, come in on time, and hit these beats that I've given you.
Yeah, valuable, I think. Valuable experience.
I have nothing but respect for the Corman School of Films. I grew up like watching a lot of the kind of crappy movies he was making in the 90s, like Carnosaur. Like I loved the Carnosaur movies when I was a kid. Basically everything that he made that was showing on the Sci-Fi Channel, I was watching the hell out of.
Yeah.
So nothing but respect for this guy's output.
And then you get a couple bangers every once in a while. You get a Death Race.
You get Death Race, you get a Mask the Red Death.
Yep.
You get a Piranha 2.
Mm-hmm.
There's three. Is it Piranha 3? Was that the Cameron one?
No idea. I've only seen the first one.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So how are you feeling final thoughts-wise on Death Race 2000?
It's a pretty good one. It's a goofer. I do think that the like dissonance between the... I don't know. There's like this like element of it being a little serious at times and then also being goofy. And I kind of wish it leaned more into the goofiness. Like I kind of wish that like Bartel got his way and there were more gags in it. It the way it is, it kind of feels caught in between. And I kind of like the idea of it being hyper violent at times and also super goofy at times. But I feel like I want a few more gags, a few less scenes of Cara Dune and his navigator talking and like the drama between them and their car, and a few more like people getting killed in wacky ways.
Mm.
But it's pretty good. Like Stallone's fucking great. Cara Dune's good. The role of Frankenstein doesn't give him a lot to do. I think like the movie's like relying on his star power as like a big TV actor that the audience would really know to carry through that character, who is sort of like a, I don't say stoic, like a quiet tough guy is what he is. So there's not a lot for Cara Dune to do in the role. He's pretty good. Like Stallone's obviously like, I think the breakout like screen presence of this movie. He is a lot of fun. When the action blows up, like at the end with the airplane, as we said, just great. The money's on screen at that point. It hits some interesting visuals at times. It's good. It's goofy fun. It's a good 80 minutes. I would give it like, I'm going to go 3 stars on it. It's like it's a solid good time at the movies. It hits the promises. Like I don't think there's anything anyone can say to analyze this movie in a way that can sell you on it or pull you away from it. If you've heard the concept, it's Cara Dune, it's Stallone, it's Cove. They are going to race across the country and try to kill people. And if that idea of guys in wacky Hot Wheels cars killing people in wacky cartoony ways, you already know if you want to watch this movie. And it delivers on what you want from that. I can't sell anyone on it and I can't push anyone away from it. Like, it is exactly what you want it to be. It's exactly what it says it is. It's a good time.
Yeah, I think we are, you know, once again, I feel like we've been pretty consistently like in lockstep with these movies.
I want us to hit our Siskel and Ebert moment where we fight.
Yeah.
Idiot. How could you not like this movie?
We will diverge eventually at some point.
I keep watching Siskel and Ebert clips and thinking like, man, I wish I fought on my show.
I think I'm too easily persuaded. But yeah, I think I'm also sitting around like a 3 on this. It was nice to, since we are usually in such like a middle brow and like competent professional movie space, it was nice getting into something that was like no budget, extremely adolescent, fun type deal, which I think, I don't think we've like gone outside of our mandate or anything with this one. I think this is still...
Oh, yeah. It's one of my dad's... It was one of the first movies my dad mentioned when I asked him for, like, suggestions for movies that would be, like, movies that he loves that I could cover on the podcast. This was, like, one of the first movies he brought up.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I think it's fun to watch, and it's only 80 minutes long, so, like, it's doing what it's doing. I think there are other, you know, kind of B movies or exploitation movies that kind of transcend a little more than this one does for me. But yeah, I mean, it's super fun. It's funny as fuck. Super funny to watch. Yeah, liked it a lot.
Yeah, like a 3 out of 5 is not a bad score. That's a good score.
No, yeah, it might seem bad because it seems like we're constantly giving things 4 and 5 stars, but... No, this would be not like near the top of ones that we've watched for this show, I think. But I mean, I had a blast watching it.
Yeah. This is like an easy recommendation. This is a movie that I would like to watch again. Like, this is a movie, this is like a rewatchable movie.
Yeah, I think this is a one, too, that would be like fun to have on with a group or like in the background of a party.
Mm-hmm.
A fun one to like riff on and talk over.
A fun one to show people too, just like anyone who hasn't seen it before.
Yeah.
Especially because it sells itself. You tell someone a movie's called Death Race 2000, you hit people for points. That's it. That's the movie. Like that's the one of the greatest pitches you could make.
It's a sick title. Like,
yeah.
If there were 2 near future sport apocalypse movies and I knew nothing else about them except for one was called Rollerball and one was called Death Race 2000, I'm going to see fucking Death Race 2000.
Yeah. Yes. That's the thing, man. Sometimes a movie's whole pitch is in the title. Classics like Four Brothers, Death Race 2000.
Those are the two, really, if you think
Planet
about
of the
it.
Apes. Sometimes you hear a title and you go, I know what that movie is and I need to see it.
And I like it.
And speaking of liking movies, I can't wait to like a movie next week. Next week, we're going to be joined by Twitter's own Michael Chow at Sriracha Chow to watch The Patriot, Mel Gibson, Roland Emmerich, a true story from history, as the truest story ever told.
Yep.
We're going to learn something. Can't wait. Actually super excited. I haven't seen The Patriot since I was like a teenager.
Yeah, it's about Tom Brady, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's about touchdown Tom, never count him out. Mel
the
plays
Patriot.
Him. One of Mel, complete transformation is Mel. He learned how to play football and everything. But until then, I have been one of your hosts, Brandon. At that one get 64 on Twitter. Please follow the podcast at Dadcore Cinema on Twitter. Keep listening to it whenever you're listening to it right now. If someone slid you like a USB drive with like a mystery file on it and you hit play and you're hearing this right now, just head on over to dadcorecinema.club. You can get more episodes just like this. Well, a little bit different than this. They all cover different movies. Just go ahead and do that. Check it out. Or go on iTunes. Go anywhere. Look up Dadcore Cinema Club. We're there. Charlie, where can people find you?
You can find me at thetumboy on twitter.com.
Whoa. Who knew?
Everyone now. The word is out.
Damn. Well, we will see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.